Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. We are doing a Weird Questions today with Jimmy Akin. When you hear that music, you know you're always in for a great time with some fun questions. I am Edgar Lujano, the producer for the show and filling in for Cy Kellett today. It's always a pleasure to be with you on this side of the glass. And Jimmy, we got plenty of questions, so shall we jump back in?
Sure, absolutely.
All right, well, let's go over to Rafael Figueredo, 4858. He asks, what do you say to critics of your content on NDEs who say that it understates the skeptical research in the academic NDE literature?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First one, I actually don't have that much content on NDEs. I've done a couple of episodes of Mysterious World on it. I plan to do much more, but in the episodes I've done, especially the first one that was a general overview, I was actually very cautious about NDEs. Now, the other thing I would say is I've read a lot of the academic literature on NDEs, and I think Raphael may be under a misimpression about what that academic literature contains, because it seems that he may be under the impression that it's much more skeptical of NDEs than it actually is. There are some skeptics who have written about NDEs, like Susan Blackmore, for example, would be an example of that. She's a researcher over in the UK. And there are others too, but the skeptics actually are a pretty small group. So I think Raphael may simply not be aware of the breadth of research on near-death experiences, and it's actually much more positive than what he may be aware of. Having said that, skeptical proposals may indeed explain some NDEs or some aspects of NDE that are commonly reported in NDEs, but they don't explain it all. There is no comprehensive skeptical theory or aggregation of theories that explains all of the elements we find commonly reported in near-death experiences. So that's the first thing, is we just don't have explanatory power in the theories that skeptics have proposed. Maybe a given skeptical theory will explain some aspect that's commonly reported in NDEs or particular NDEs, but we don't have a comprehensive skeptical explanation. So lack of explanatory power is one thing. The second thing I would say is it's all speculation. You know, you will find papers like by Susan Blackmore proposing, well, here maybe this brain mechanism could explain this aspect of NDEs. Like, for example, one of the commonly reported aspects of NDEs is a sense of motion through darkness towards a light. This is often described as kind of like going down a tunnel, although not everybody uses that metaphor. There was one gentleman who, I forget if he was a truck driver or an auto mechanic, but after he had his NDE, he said it was like going through a tailpipe. but Susan Blackmore has proposed, well, maybe that experience has to do with the shutting down of the visual center at the back of your brain. Maybe your visual center shuts off in such a way that you have this experience of that's kind of tunnel-like with a light at the end of it. Okay, fine, as a proposal. But that's all it is a proposal. It is speculation. There are no empirical studies backing this up. And there's very good reason for that, why there are no empirical studies backing up any of these skeptical proposals. Would you care to take a guess at why there might be no empirical studies backing up any of these proposals, Edgar?
Maybe because the people that have gone through it have died?
No, they're still alive. At least some of them are.
Okay, I'm not sure.
You can't ethically kill people. You can't. This is not the movie Flatliners. You can't cause people to die for purposes of studying what brain phenomena are connected with what near-death experience aspects. And if you can't kill someone, you can then, you know, try to get them back. You can't run experiments on these phenomena. It is not ethical. So at least not normally. There is an exception. There are some surgeries where you do need to turn off a person's heart. And there's actually a famous incident of that where you turn off their heart, you like cool their body down and stuff like that, but you do the surgery on them that you need to repair them, and then you start their heart again. And there's actually a famous NDE account connected with that. There was an American country music star. I forget her name, but she urgently needed a surgery that required her heart to be shut off. And I believe they were working on her brain, and that's why they needed the heart shut off, so they wouldn't have blood flow through the brain as they were working on her. And they, among other things, they needed to monitor her brain waves, what was going on in her brain as part of this study. And they also blocked, they played, I believe it was clicking noises in her ears to block as a way of stimulating, what's her brain doing? Is it picking up on these clicks? But as a result of that, I mean, when her heart was offline and there's no blood flow, they're not going to pick up, she's not going to be conscious at all. And she's not going to be able to hear anything because they have these clicks that are really loud to try to get her brain to react in some way. And even though she's completely unconscious and her heart is shut off and she couldn't hear anything anyway, when she came back, she was able to do stuff like describe exactly what the surgeons were talking about. When she was clinically dead. And that is a kind of information that is known as veridical information. Veridical information is information that could not simply be guessed, so it goes beyond random chance. The person had no natural way of knowing this information, and it turns out to be true. So that's what veridical information is. It's information beyond random chance, no normal way of knowing it, and it turns out to be true. And there are a bunch of veridical aspects of near-death experiences, what happened with this particular heart-stopping incident I mentioned. But there are lots of others, too. I've often told the story of Maria's shoe. Maria was a Hispanic woman who, in the 1970s, was taken to a hospital in the American Northwest with cardiac arrest. She had an out-of-body experience. She looked down at her body and saw the doctors working on her. Then she moved her consciousness elsewhere in the hospital. She saw a blue tennis shoe on the ledge outside of a window on an upper floor of the hospital. And when they got her heart started again, she talked about this. And one of the workers at the hospital who could speak enough Spanish to communicate with her, this being the 1970s, they didn't have people who were fluent around, went and found the shoe. It was really there. And this woman had come into the hospital, you know, at night, at ground level, with this heart problem. There are many others, too. One of my favorite examples is a guy has a near-death experience. He also has, the technical term is an otoscopic experience, where you see yourself. And so he had an out-of-body experience. He's looking down at himself, watching the surgeons, and he sees this one surgeon who's Japanese flapping his arms like a chicken. And it's like, and they get his heart started again. And he asks the doctor, what were you doing with your arms? And the doctor, because it looked like you were flapping them like a chicken. And the doctor actually got kind of offended. But it came out that the doctor, the way, I don't know that he was trained this way in Japan, but he had adopted the habit when he's in the operating theater, because he didn't want to get his hand, even though they really try to keep everything in there sterile, he was afraid of getting germs on his hand while he was operating. And so what he would do is when he needed something, instead of pointing to it with his hands, he would point with his elbows. And that's what the flap in his arms was. There are numerous other examples. People have like read the serial numbers on the equipment they're using as they're looking down from the top of the room. And, you know, there's like a big light or something. They've read the serial number on the top of the light. They've, you know, heard conversations their relatives or doctors were having out in the hallway. One guy came back and said to the doctor, I noticed you ate my lunch, because he had been flat. He kept having cardiac arrest in his room. They couldn't move him to an operating theater. They were trying to get his heart stabilized in good rhythm, but he kept flatlining. And so his doctor, who was brand new, he was, I forget if he was an intern or just out of his internship, but this was like the first time he had had to care for someone in this situation. The guy kept flatlining, so he had to stay in the room to give him shocks to re-jolt his heart. And he felt like, they're leaving me here all alone, and I'm brand new. They should be here with me, and it's been several hours I've been staying with this guy, and I'm getting hungry, and they haven't brought me any food, but here's his lunch. And the guy said, while I was out, you thought, why are they leaving me here alone? And then you ate my lunch. So there are a huge number of veridical experiences that are reported in NDEs. There's a whole book about them, in fact, by a group of researchers led by Titus Rivas, who's a European researcher. The book is called The Self Does Not Die, but it's got over 100 veridical NDEs that have confirmation from medical personnel. Also, there are other interesting veridical aspects of NDEs. Like, one of them is psychopomps. So a psychopomp is a soul guide. And sometimes the psychopomps that people, they're like there to bring you into the afterlife. And they tend to be one of two kinds. Either they're identified as angels or as deceased relatives. So sometimes it's an angel that shows up to bring you into the afterlife. Sometimes it's a relative. But what they've noticed is when it's a family member or someone you know, that person's always dead. They're genuinely dead. Now, if this were all a hallucination, there ought to be living people showing up as psychopomps. Like, if you're just dreaming this, well, your dreams aren't all about dead people you've known. They include living people. But we don't see living people among the psychopomps that are reported in these experiences. And then there are what are known as shared death experiences, where a living person who's present shares in the NDE. So they may see the person's soul get out of their body. They may experience the light and the joy and the music. They may see the psychopomps. It's also reported there are distortions of space. When the death process is happening. But here we have someone who is not dead and not dying, standing right there, mentally perceiving what the dying person is going through. And if the dying person doesn't die, they can then confirm that. So that's an additional form of veridical experience. And so there are multiple different aspects of near-death experiences that a standard skeptical account has no way of accounting for. Now, does that prove that near-death experiences are genuinely cases of human survival beyond bodily death? Well, properly speaking, and here I'm showing myself being scientific, properly speaking, the answer is no. Because there is another explanation besides survival that could account for this, and that is psychic functioning. Maybe, for example, Maria, who had the shoe, maybe she didn't really survive her death when her heart was stopped. Maybe she was just a clairvoyant, and she clairvoyantly perceived the shoe and then misremembered it as a perception she had while her heart was stopped. This is an explanation that's sometimes called living agent psi. The idea is it's really psychic functioning being done by a living person. But there are problems with the living agent psi explanation. And I think the balance of evidence very strongly indicates that near-death experiences are instances of survival. I don't have time to go into all the reasons why, but I think that's what the evidence strongly indicates. But in either event, standard skeptical accounts that say, oh, this is all natural, there's nothing paranormal going on here, that's clearly wrong. Because the skeptical accounts have no way of accounting for the veridical information these experiences contain. Psychic functioning might, but that's not a normal, natural explanation. So you either got to say there's genuine survival of bodily death or at least psychic functioning happening, neither one of which is a skeptic is going to be happy about.
Raphael, thanks for that question. Time for our first break. When we come back, more weird questions with Jimmy Akin.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
All this month, we continue to honor the Blessed Virgin Mary with special devotions, prayers, and acts of veneration. And of course, Catholic Radio's premier shows featuring Deacon Harold Burke Sivers, Ave Maria in the Afternoon, Women of Grace with John M. Williams, EWTN News in Depth, and more. EWTN Radio, your source of truth that allows Catholics to grow in their faith and recognize the true mission of the Catholic Church.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for joining us, and we're doing weird questions, which is always fun to go through. So we jump back in. F-Man
today. Today we've been having a lot of afterlife questions.
That's so a good point.
We'll see if that, yeah.
Yeah, afterlife questions, and then I think the first one of the possessions question with MK Ultra. I think that one blew my mind in the beginning of this episode. Didn't realize all of it was still happening.
My work here is almost done.
Almost. Maybe in about 40 minutes, your work here is almost done. Yeah. All right. F-Man 6956 asks, what do you think of the way purification seems to occur in Father Nathan Castle's afterlife accounts? It would seem that rather than experiencing a painful and fiery purification, as often depicted in pious stories and prayers about purgatory over the centuries, the souls essentially just learn new things and gradually correct their misunderstandings and errors, including needing to come to grips with their past sins and their effects on others. The idea that angels, saints, and deceased relatives all get involved at different points along the journey of purification of souls and to help them move to a new level is really appeals to me.
Okay, so first I should mention who Father Nathan Castle is for those who may not be familiar. He's a Dominican priest in the western province of the United States, and he reports that he regularly, like it, I think at least weekly, has a dream in which he's contacted by a person who died a violent death. And the person who died the violent death, he sees how that person died, and then he knows he needs to contact this person. And so he'll go into prayer, and they'll pray, you know, for protection. They pray to Saint Michael, they pray to the Blessed Virgin and so forth, but they pray that they may have contact with the spirit. And so this is not him reaching out to make contact with spirits. He's just responding. So this is a form of responsive communication. It's like if an apparition showed up to you and said, hey, I'm a soul in purgatory, I need prayer. Well, you could respond to him, like we talked about earlier. And he's doing that. He's doing responsive communication. He's not on his own initiative saying, oh, I want to talk to dead folks. He's waiting until he has an apparition in a dream, and then he tries to help that person, just like St. Thomas Aquinas did with his sister. Now, the way this works is he tries to, you know, speak with the spirit and essentially give them a kind of counseling to help them move on in the afterlife, because they may have various resentments and ties to things on earth that they need to let go of in order to make progress spiritually. You know, like they may be still just bitterly resenting how they died, for example, since they died violently. Well, okay, well, that's one of the things that one would need to let go of to make spiritual progress. And that's similar to what the Catechism says the purpose of purgatory is, that it's to purify us of our attachments to things from this life that are disordered, you know, things like resentments and so forth. Now, the way Father Castle, and by the way, I have a couple of episodes of Mysterious World where I, in one of them, I interview Father Castle, and in another, I give a theological analysis of his work. So people can check those out for more information. But F-Man is asking about is, this sounds different than a lot of the common language that's been used, at least here in the West, for purgatory, where it's envisioned as having this fiery purification. Well, okay, it does sound different. There are a few things I would note. The first thing I would say is I suspect all of these perceptions are heavily culturally conditioned, no matter who is claiming to have experienced contact with a soul from purgatory. I think because we are not designed in this life to understand the afterlife, we have to understand it in terms of the images that we have in our imagination and things like that. This is something Pope Benedict talked about in Spes Salvi, that, you know, we're scripture and tradition present us with images, but they shouldn't be taken literally, because we're not able to imagine what the realities are going to be like. One of the images that's become common in the West in connection with afterlife purification is fire. Because St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3 that our works will be tested by fire on Judgment Day. And that image has not been used in the East the way it is in the West. So that of itself would suggest this is a culturally conditioned image. Now, what it represents is also an interesting question. There were people in the Middle Ages who would argue, oh, it's literal physical fire. Okay, but if you don't have a body in the afterlife, how does physical fire affect you when you don't have a physical form? And there was a split on this question. Some people said, oh, well, God can miraculously make it have an physical fire have an influence on your immaterial soul. Other people said, nah, I think the fire is a symbol of something else. Recently, Pope Benedict favored that idea. He didn't mandate it, but he favored that idea that the image of fire should be understood as a transforming encounter with Christ and his love. It's like his love burns away all of our impurities and enables us to be ready for the glory of heaven. Okay, so there have been people who have understood purgatory in terms of fire, whereas Father Castle seems to understand it primarily in terms of like counseling or education or something like that. But that also has a and it's also much more imaginative than just people burning in fire until they're ready to go to heaven. And that also has a precedent in Catholic history. There are multiple apparitions of purgatorial souls that aren't just people burning in fire, that something much more interesting is going on where they're not clearly suffering. That's a nice cliffhanger, so I'll tell you the rest of that story on the other side of the break.
All right, perfect. Perfect place to put a comma. A comma would be the best way of putting it. So we'll put a comma on that one. When we come back, we'll finish off this question on Catholic Answers Live.
Who was Jesus? It's the most important question in the world. Was he a great teacher, a religious myth, the Messiah and Lord? In Evidence for Christ, apologist Jimmy Akin builds a powerful step-by-step case from history, scripture, and reason showing that Jesus is the fulfillment of prophecy and the risen Lord. Get your copy of Jimmy Akin's Evidence for Christ today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The world has a lot of questions about Catholicism. It's a big faith, and it deserves a big book of answers. Well, now it has two. Get the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, and have 300 clear, reliable Catholic answers right at your fingertips whenever something comes up at work, with friends, or around the dinner table. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Why do we baptize? Does it really do anything? In Baptism Now Saves You, Dr. Carlo Broussard explains the unbreakable relationship between baptism and salvation, making sense of the Church's teachings in a way that is easy to understand and ready to share. St. Peter said, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you." Discover what that means today. Order your copy of Baptism Now Saves You at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, you were in the middle of answering a question about the afterlife, I guess, predictions?
And purgatory.
Purgatory of Father Nathan Castle. So you were in the middle of that.
Yeah. So I was contrasting, or the F-man who asked the question noted that that many people historically in the West have understood purgatory as involving fire as the thing that purifies you. But Father Castle reports, at least with the souls he encounters, that he reports encountering, that it's different. It's more like educational or counseling, and it's something much more interesting than and different than just, well, I'm being purged by this flame. And there are echoes of that more diverse and approach to things in Christian history. There are lots of accounts of purgatorial souls that are being purified, but not in a way that involves any kind of flame. For example, in his dialogues, St. Gregory the Great records a bunch of paranormal experiences. In fact, I recently went through the dialogues. It's four books long, but I went through all four books and classified each paranormal experience that Gregory records in modern terms. Like, you know, this would be a telepathic experience, this would be a clairvoyant experience, this would be, you know, an apparition, and so forth. And there's like, I think going on 300 experiences in the dialogues, and it makes a really fascinating little database. I'm going to be doing an article on this and making the data available for researchers so they can look up. Like, if you're interested in purgatorial apparitions, you can look them up, and here's a whole list of them from the dialogues. Well, one of them, and Gregory's also really good about telling us what his source was. He doesn't just say, I heard this somewhere. He'll say, this bishop told me this story about his priest by this name. And in one of those stories that I forget what bishop Gregory named, told him about this, but one of the priests, one of the bishop's priests would do a very common thing back in the day. He'd go to the bathhouse regularly and bathe, because they didn't have bathtubs in private homes typically, maybe if you were super wealthy or something. Instead, you had to go to a local bathhouse and to get a bath. And this was actually a kind of a big experience in the Roman world. They had not just baths, they had saunas, they had hot baths, they had cold baths, they had exercise rooms so you could get your workout. They had libraries there, so you could get a book and read it while you're in your bath. And they had bath attendants. So this priest is going to this one bathhouse regularly, and there's an attendant there who helps him, you know, and it's, he notices it's the same attendant. Whenever he goes there, there's this attendant. The attendant helps him out. He's really kind. He's really dutiful. He's really helpful. And the priest starts thinking, he's been so helpful to me, I ought to do something nice for him. So what the priest did was he got a couple of loaves of bread and he took them to the bathhouse the next time he went. And then the guy helps him. And as the priest is getting ready to go, he said, hey, you've been so kind to me, I wanted to do something nice for you. Please accept these loaves of bread. And it's at that point that the bath attendant says, well, I'd love to, but I can't. And it's not that he's not allowed to receive gifts. It's he can't accept them because he's not a living person. He's an apparition of a ghost being purified in purgatory. He says, I used to be the owner of the bathhouse, but for my sins, I've been assigned to come back and serve at the bathhouse as an attendant. You know, maybe he treated his attendants badly in life or something, so now he's got to be one of them. But he says, if you really want to help me, take the bread and use it to consecrate the Holy Eucharist and, you know, have Mass said for me. And you'll know that if it works, you'll know it works when you come back and I'm not here anymore. So the priest took the loaves of bread, and they were leavened because people, even in the West, used leavened bread at the time for the Eucharist. So he takes the loaves, he uses them to say Mass, he goes back to the bathhouse, and the attendant isn't there anymore. And he concludes that the attendant has gone to heaven, that his purification is over. Well, okay, so it was Mass that got him over the hump, that it was the final bit of his purification that let him get into heaven. But he was already being purified by working as a bath attendant, as an apparition. Now, whether you now Gregory thinks this is totally credible. Whether you do is a matter for you to determine, but it is common for purgatorial experiences to be reported like this in Christian history. And that would suggest that there are other ways God can purify someone besides just, you know, putting them on a spit on the heavenly barbecue. So I don't see any problem with the way Father Castle understands this. There are more options. God is bigger than either single option. And I try not to limit God in what he might do. What I would suspect, if you ask me, is that both Father Castle and people who might see a purgatorial soul, you know, being purified by flame, because flame is a sign of purification, a symbol of purification in the Bible. Well, if you're, if in your imagination, if in your mind, you primarily associate purification in the afterlife with fire, well, then you might pick up, your subconscious might represent purgatory to you that way. On the other hand, if it's not the primary metaphor for you, your subconscious might represent purgatory and apparitions from purgatory in another way. I would suspect that both people would be picking up on aspects of things, and I would be inclined to say neither vision is likely to be fully complete and fully literal. I would suspect that the reality of afterlife purification or purgatory is more complex, not just than we do imagine, but that we than that we can imagine. But I think different people pick up on different aspects of it depending on their background.
I can imagine that the owner of the bathhouse, he's passes away and he thinks, all right, I'm ready for the next part. And he lands up back at the bathhouse like, oh man, what did I do wrong?
So, back to square one, dude.
Exactly. F-Man, thanks for that question. Rudu9451 asks, if two individuals had their brains swapped, would their soul remain in their original bodies? Or if it stayed, how would this mismatched soul/brain experience consciousness?
Okay, the answer to this question is undetermined. The church has no teaching on this, and there's not even, as far as I'm aware, any even common opinion on this. The idea of brain swaps is so new. It is talked about now in medical science, but it's so new that that I don't think any kind of consensus has emerged, even as a matter of opinion. So I can't give, and I don't have a firm opinion here myself, but I can talk about some of the options. So one of the things I would say is we need to figure out the relationship between the soul and the brain in order to answer this question. To the extent that the soul, which is the life principle of the body that makes you alive, to the extent that the soul primarily operates through the brain, there could be a kind of soul swap. So your soul is what keeps your body alive, and that happens through the brain. You know, you take someone's brain out, they're going to die. So you could argue the soul principally operates through the brain, even if it extends to other aspects of the body. So if you move the brain that is essential for life from one person to another, then you're essentially transferring not just the brain, but the soul along with it. So if you do the brain swap, they're each going to have the soul of the other. A is going to have B's soul, and B is going to have A's soul. That's possible. It's also commonly understood. Oh, let me mention another possibility before I move on. It's also possible that the brain is not tied to the soul in any essential way. One proposal that has been made and that is actually growing in popularity in neuroscience circles is that the brain may not be the seat of consciousness. It may be a filter that is designed to shape how consciousness functions, but it's otherwise completely independent. And if that's the case, if consciousness is not tied to the brain in any essential way, it's would be hypothetically possible you could swap the brains and the soul would remain with the original body. So that also would be possible. It would just be operating through a new brain now. Now, traditionally, the soul has been understood as an indivisible entity. And there are philosophical arguments for that, but they aren't mandated as matters of doctrine. So could it be that the soul might have parts, and part of the soul might remain with the original body, even if the core of the soul transfers to the new body? Well, there's an interesting piece of evidence for that, which is there are situations with organ transplants, not the brain, but other organs, where some really strange stuff happens, that the person who is the organ recipient seems to get information from the organ donor, even if they don't know the organ donor. I'll give you an example. This was an instance where you had a guy whose lungs were shot, and he needed a heart-lung transplant. They found a donor, but that guy, the donor himself, needed a transplant but was able to donate his heart. So you have the heart of donor A going into a second person, but neither one of them has to die because that guy then gets another new heart. And the medical situation is complex. This is not a usual one, but this kind of transplant, double transplant, does happen. So you've got these two guys, they're alive. Guy B has guy A's heart. And guy B not only starts to have food preferences that guy A had, he also starts calling guy his own wife's name by the name of guy A's wife.
Wow.
So let's say guy A, his wife is named Lois, and guy B's wife is named Lana. Well, guy B starts calling Lana Lois, and he didn't know guy A. So it's like there's something transferring more than just a heart here. Now, could that be a piece of the soul? Well, maybe if the soul's individual, is not indivisible. I don't want to propose that. That gets us, as anything other than, well, hypothetically. I think there are other explanations, like maybe some kind of residue other than your soul gets transferred along with the heart in that case. So I just mentioned those as hypothetical possibilities. I'm not endorsing them. There's also an interesting possibility that I've never heard anybody propose. In fact, I've never heard anybody propose most of these. But it could be because souls don't have physical form. Aquinas would say they don't literally have a physical location. And so you can only metaphorically conceive of a spirit being present where it's active. Okay, if we go with that, then could your soul be active in more than one body? Could it be that your soul is running through the brain and the rest of the body you used to have? In that case, you could have the person's soul both operating through the brain in their new body and operating through everything but the brain in their old body, in which case you'd have a kind of cross soul pattern with part, if you do a brain swap, where you've got parts of two souls swapped, but the rest of their souls continuing to animate the rest of their bodies. So that's another possibility. What the answer is here, I don't claim to know. I'm just trying to sketch out the conceptual space of what are some of the possibilities.
Well, it goes to show you as well that something that was once just science fiction, now it's becoming reality. It's creating new dilemmas for us humans. That's fascinating. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, let's.
Fortunately, we're not there yet, but we need to be thinking about places that mad scientists might soon take us.
Yeah, you don't say. All right, well, with that, we'll go to our final break and we'll finish it off with these weird questions with Jimmy Akin.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Alexian Brothers is a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. For 800 years, these Catholic brothers have offered a prophetic and daring response to the gospel. Serving Christ in the sick, the poor, and the dying. Is God calling you to be a courageous disciple? If you feel called to total self-giving as a religious brother in the mission of Jesus, call our vocations office at 847-264-8703. That's 847-264-8703. AlexianBrothers.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I'm continually amazed and humbled at the way God can work through me to help so many people. Although I have no idea what the caller's questions will be that day, I trust that the Holy Spirit can use my education and experience to guide, challenge, or comfort those who call.
Mast Appeal with Colleen Kelly Mast, Saturday morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. We're going down through the list of weird questions on this Friday afternoon or evening or Saturday morning, wherever you are on the planet, or if you're listening to it on podcast, because you could also do that some other day. So let's continue on with more weird questions. We go over to Caleb Henderson 3817, who asks, "My wife is utterly convinced that all lizards, including and especially the dinosaurs, used to be dragons, and wings were the limbs mentioned in Genesis when God punished the serpent. Note that most modern-day lizards, although they do have legs, still scurry around on their bellies because of their wide stance."
Okay, so I'm not going to say that there's no possibility that your wife's proposal is correct, because anything that's logically possible, God could make happen. But I do try to evaluate proposals in light of the evidence we have for them. And in this, and I tend to look at things from the perspectives of faith and reason, and I tend with scriptural questions like this to look at it from the perspective of faith first. Now, one thing I'll note is that the church, and this is indicated in the Catechism, it's also indicated in other places like Pope Pius XII's 1950 encyclical Humanae Generis, and I've talked about this in the Jimmy Akin podcast in recent episodes. The church has already discerned that that the first 11 chapters of Genesis contain a good bit of symbolic information. And the serpent has been commonly understood in recent magisterial texts as a symbol of the devil, but not as a literal snake. And that would put us on guard against trying to get scientific information about dragons and dinosaurs and lizards out of this text. Having said that, if we set that aside, I would say that the proposal actually goes beyond what's in the text. Even if you take the text fully literally, it is involving elements that are not mentioned, like the wings. You say your wife believes that the limbs that the serpent would have lost would have been wings. And wings are not mentioned in the relevant texts. They're not mentioned in Genesis. God doesn't describe the serpent as having wings there. And God doesn't, in the other passage where the serpent shows up in a similar form as a dragon, is in Revelation. And wings are not mentioned in Revelation either. God doesn't describe that dragon as having wings. He describes it as having heads and horns and a tail, but there's no mention of it having wings. So that would be adding onto the text. And that would be another reason I would be cautious about this proposal, is we don't even have the concept of wings mentioned here. Also, given that wings are not even mentioned, and also creatures that have wings tend to have physical legs as well, like, you know, birds, they don't just have wings, they've got legs too. And so I would expect that the serpent in Genesis, if we were taking this text fully literally, well, it would have legs. And if God were talking about removing its wings, well, then it would still have the legs. So I think legs are definitely involved here. And the original meaning of when Genesis says, "On your belly you shall go," would most naturally be understood as a loss of legs. Because if it doesn't lose its legs, it wouldn't have to go on its belly. And the fact that snakes don't have legs is, you know, one of the most notable things about them. They're unlike other animals. That's the main thing that makes them different from other animals, is they ain't got any legs. So I think that's the obvious meaning of "on your belly you shall go," is you're not going to have legs. If it wasn't the loss of legs, well, then snakes ought to still have them. They ought to be lizards. So I think that from a faith perspective, looking at this as a religious text, as a person who shares the faith, I would say this proposal is not well supported by the exegetical and theological evidence. What about scientific evidence? Is there anything here from the perspective of science? Well, dinosaurs did not have legs like lizards. Lizards have what are called sprawling legs that stick out from the sides of their bodies, and they can kind of like scurry along on their belly. And crocodiles similarly have sprawling legs, but lizards and crocodiles are not dinosaurs. What dinosaurs are is a kind of creature that has a special kind of hip that causes the legs not to spread out from the body, but to be underneath the body. It's called the parasagittal posture. But all dinosaurs, properly speaking, have a parasagittal posture. You know, like if you look at a T-Rex or a Triceratops or a Brontosaurus, none of them have legs that stick out from their bodies. All of them have an upright posture with the legs under their bodies. And so do their descendants, birds. If you think about the legs birds have, they're also under their bodies. And that's why birds actually are a kind of dinosaur. So the idea that the dinosaurs, that all lizards, including and especially the dinosaurs, used to be dragons with wings, it not only would be hard to square with the biblical data, it also would be hard to square with the scientific data, because dinosaurs are a completely different kind of animal than lizards. And we have no evidence from the fossil record that lizards used to have wings. Some dinosaurs did, but in any event, I guess that's what I'd have to say, broadly speaking, about the proposal. I want to compliment your wife for thinking about it and trying to come up with explanations. That's always a good thing, trying to think through things. But it would be hard for me to support this idea either on biblical grounds or on scientific grounds. In fact, you know, modern birds are descended from theropods, which are the family of dinosaurs that T-Rexes belong to. So they're not descended from T-Rexes. They all died after the comet or meteor asteroid that struck the Earth 66 million years ago. But they're from the same family of dinosaurs. So if you ever are If you ever, you know, like go to KFC and get a bucket of chicken, you can honestly say you're eating dinosaur tonight. And you know what? Dinosaur tastes like chicken.
A bucket of T-Rex, huh? That's what we're doing tonight. Yeah. There you go. Perfect.
Bucket of theropod, at least.
Theropod. Yeah. There you go. All right. Well, thanks for your question, Caleb. And also thank your wife for us, because that was a great thought experiment that she allowed us to go through. Jimmy, that was a very quick 2 hours. Thank you for joining me.
No, it's my pleasure.
All right. Well, that'll do it for us here. It's hopefully you all got a enjoyable and also great new understanding and appreciation for a lot of things in this life, especially for chicken. I certainly hope so. Well, that'll do it for us. We will see you next time. Cy will be back in this host chair next week, starting on Tuesday. So we will see you here next week. Have a great weekend. We will see you all next time, right here, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.